This is the Takeaway Weekender for the weekend of June 20th, 2015, longest day of the year weekend. And you've got a great podcast right here. Relax, enjoy the daylight hours or whatever time it is. We're going to begin by introducing you to a first responder. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I say first responder, and what do you think of? Policeman, right? Fireman, paramedic. How about poet?
You know, it's I've been thinking about it all morning. I've been scratching and scribbling about it.
That's Juan Felipe Herrera, who for a time was a first responder to the events in Charleston, South Carolina this month. We spoke to the just-named poet laureate of the United States not long after the shooting in Charleston that killed 9 people. And he was taking it upon himself as a poet, as the poet laureate of the United States, to find a role to use language to name history, even the history we don't like to talk about. Today on The Weekender, the power of language as a first responder and a deep expresser of our innermost thoughts, beliefs, and ideals. What does it mean to be a national poet?
It's really an invitation. I'm inviting everybody to really let their poetry come out and to bring it out as far as they can publicly, and to share it and to translate it and to play with it and to throw it all the way so I can catch it and then throw it all the way back and maybe make a big old circle around the globe. It's an invitation. My message is play with life with your words.
And you do play with language, and language is pretty important to your work because, as a Chicano, you describe the border of the United States, that sort of netherworld, for lack of a better word, because I'm not a poet, I don't have good words, of America's Spanish heritage, Mexican heritage, and English-speaking heritage. It's all mixed together in your work and the world that you describe.
Well, you know, that's right. You know, the more cultures, the more histories, the more words, and the more compassion, the more of an embrace and multiple embraces that we can generate with our words, our language, and our breath and our writing. For me, it's a good thing. Yes, it's a very good thing. Less borders, less barriers, less hindrances, less violence. That's what I'm after. I think we're all after that.
Why is Allen Ginsberg such an important influence for you? I did the last interview with Allen Ginsberg before he died, and I interviewed him many times, and I found myself just as in awe of him as you seem to have been. But what struck you in the work of Allen Ginsberg?
What struck me was his life, his complete openness, his complete sincerity, his multiple experiences and journeys and cross-cultural world traveling, jotting, scribbling, photographing, parading, thinking, carving through knowledge systems, playing music, calypsos, blues, instruments, and just being perhaps one of the freest poets and human beings that I know as a writer and throughout the media and in the city. And, I just love his expansiveness.
Do you think he would go along with his poet laureate business? He was a critic of governments and, a famous rebel.
He was a famous rebel, and I think he would. I think he would have a great time with it. You know, I don't think there's one thing that he didn't have a great time with, even if he was against it, for it, in the middle of it, parading in it. I think he would. It would be more. It'd be more fodder for Ginsberg's fodder box, and he would have a great time for sure.
What are you looking forward to doing during this next year? You described travel, at least in the abstract, a moment ago. Is that something literally you want to do?
Yes, it is. You know, I think the more travel we get into, the more we drive through communities and stop in communities and stick around, say hello, listen, take notes, get jarred. Recreate ourselves because we thought we had it together, and then we find out that we actually didn't. When someone tells us, you know, I just wrote a poem about rape, and here I am thinking about, choirs. And I go, yes, choirs are important, and I will do choir work and voice ensembles. But I hadn't been stopped, even though I had thought about all this and have been concerned about issues of rape and violence against women. I went shopping, and yesterday I went to one of my favorite art stores in Fresno, California. And one of the my friends there, she says, I just finished writing a poem about rape. And I go, of course, you know, geez, right? Oh, you know, this is big. It's very big. And why hadn't I thought about it? And now I'm thinking about it. This is something that's very important. And it's an extreme, powerful, important, significant experience to write about. If we can write about it, let's write about it, and let's say it. If we can say it. And she was telling me about it. And that's why it's good to move around, to get out of our small rooms, small buses, and meet people and let them smack us with their truth and stop us, because actually, I didn't know it. I didn't know it all. I don't know it all. And the more I hear things, the more I move around from place to place, the more I see things, and the more I include things. That's why it's so important.
Does that encounter change, knowing that you are a poet laureate and that you have some kind of responsibility, and that this omission of yours, not having written a poem about rape, suddenly seems much more significant than it might have in the past?
Yes, exactly. It's about change. And it's about, you know, personal change. It's about just stopping our thoughts and mind machine, and embracing and taking in and thinking, and stopping the thinking machine too, and getting much deeper to those very painful places, those horrible experiences that I have had and others have had. And pulling them up, dredging them up, and maybe we're not going to say it all, but let's test ourselves. Yes, that's what it is. It's about change, and it's that kind of change. It's not thought. It's not I have an idea change, or I'm going to try on a new outfit change, or it's that kind of change. It's emptying myself, starting over kind of change.
Can I ask you to invite us into your thinking machine, your idea machine, your engine? How did you approach this subject as a poet? What words did you choose? How did you play around with them? And, you know, you don't have to tell me what you came up with necessarily, but I'd love to know how your mind works.
I wish I knew how my mind works.
And don't we all, right?
Yeah. Well, in terms of getting to your question, it's about going up. It's about going back, or going into my deep present, about my early childhood experiences. It's about how much pain I experienced as a child, the kind of difficult, painful, poverty world I lived in, and how ashamed I felt, and how it just ravaged me. And my mother was very supportive, of course, and my father was very supportive. It's not about them. It's just about that, that terrible feeling of being so far away from what's going on, and being brown and being poor and being mistreated by teachers, by other kids, by men, and trying to hide it, and not being able to talk about it, and feeling ashamed.
Power. So poverty is a form of violence. It's a degradation.
It's a form of violence. And so until when Lucille Sampson in third grade asked me to come up in front of class and sing. And that was the very, very, very last thing. It was even further than the last thing. It was the last of the very last. And so I stepped up there, and she was very warm, and she had, you know, just a great connection with all of us in the class in Lowell Elementary in San Diego, California, I think it was 1956. And she used to play a lot of gospel music. And so I came up in front of the class somehow and sang. And then she turned to me and said, "You have a beautiful voice." And I understood the English by then. And I didn't understand the phrase, because how could it ever apply to me? So it was like something just going by me, yet it was for me. But it was kind of going by me. It was like window shopping, when in fact, it was me. It wasn't window shopping. I wasn't just walking by, seeing something, hearing something. So that stopped me in third grade. From that day on, I had this compliment or encouragement that was next to me and always was with me, yet I never really turned around to embrace it until I was stopped again in sixth grade. Mr. Robert Hayden said, "Well, you know, why don't you do theater in this class and create a story and perform it with the students?" I said, "Why are you telling me that? I have no idea what that means. How come you have that kind of faith in me? I never even thought of something like that." So he did have confidence, and I did do it. And then in seventh grade, Mr. Schuster said, "What are you?" in my music class, and I said, "Hawaiian." But I said, "I'm lying, even though I wish I could be Hawaiian, because I had just come back from San Francisco, but I was Mexican, and I wasn't able to say it." So then I said, that's it. I said to myself, I'm stopping this whole train that's taken me, that's off the rails and going down some cliff into an abyss. I'm going to have to step into choir, and where I know people, the teacher is going to ask me to step forward and sing in front of everybody every day. And until I do that year after year, will I be more comfortable and be able to speak up? Because I want to speak up. I want to be that person that speaks up and is sincere and is not afraid and will say what I want to say and will say, "This is who I am." So it took all those trials and errors for me to get where I'm at today.
And you're definitely up in front of the class, that's for sure.
I'm in front of the class. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
What do you make of the events of this week in South Carolina?
You know, it's I've been thinking about it all morning. I've been scratching and scribbling about it and thinking about what I'm going to do as a U.S. Poet Laureate, and I want to include this whole thing about violence. I was thinking about it already, but I think it's hit all of us in the face once again, and it keeps on doing this. I think it's very sad. I think it's incredible. I think I extend my condolences to all the families and children and parents and the entire families involved, the entire city, the entire state, and the entire nation. And it's very saddening. I think all of us feel like this, and I also feel for the young person that did all this. And I think about that, and I think about what happens in our city and our society that kind of skews us. You know, it just bends us. And we do these things. I know there's individual choices, and it's not the city's fault, and it's not, you know, it's not A or B or C. But when we lack resources, and we lack mental health services, and we lack all those support systems that all of us need to be healthy and complete human beings, we will bend and break and do terrible, ugly things to others and to ourselves. Not to mention the kind of points of view that sometimes we gather from poisonous vines or poisonous sources, and we see that others of a different color, faith, or religion, or gender, or sexual orientation are are people that we can mutilate, you know, and kill, even though it's wrong, you know, we go ahead and do it. So I feel, most of all, I feel a lot of compassion for those that have been hurt and those who are hurting, and I send my condolences and my love to them. Mm.
Juan Felipe Herrera's works are lyrics about the possibility of empathy from the perspective of a son of farm workers who grew up in poverty in California, in a nation where people of different worlds seem to him to lack any emotional curiosity about each other. Here's a part of his poem, Song Out There.
Can you turn around so I can look into your eyes? Just for once, your eyes, maybe like hers. Can you see her? And his. Can you see them? I want you to see them.
From poetry to music. This old song called Oil on the Brain was sung in the middle of the oil boom in the 1800s as this frenzy to get rich was chased by the demand for fuels that were beginning to change the world. Today's oil boom in places like North Dakota and Wyoming, where we began this hour, is a continuation of that frenzy with some new lyrics this time around.
Rivers running brown, money changing hands, cracking underground. We're wringing every last drop from the land just because it's down there.
For Grammy Award-winning musician Tom Chapin, the oil boom has become a dangerous fracking boom. And that's how we end this hour. Next week, Chapin and other artists assembled by producer Jason Sammel will release Buy This Fracking album. It will be downloadable on June 23rd. Jason and Tom Chapin, with his instrument, visited us recently to talk about fracking, to play some protest songs, and to discuss the power of political music in the age of Instagram.
The great thing about music is that if it works, it gets in. It's like a little brain worm that sits there. And if it's telling the truth and you connect with it, I remember songs that I learned when I was, 3 years old, and they still stay there. I think that's one of the reasons that Pete Seeger used to say that when a dictator took over, the first thing they wiped out were the artists and musicians. Mm-hmm. Because we're dangerous.
Who's the audience for this album, and what artists did you manage to get to be on this album, Jay?
Sure. I mean, I try to bring on folks from every type of genre to have as wide of an audience as possible. So we have folks anywhere from, folk music to punk music to hip-hop to reggae. And there's obviously a kind of a inborn audience to each one of those artists that represent those genres, but I think the audience that I'm trying to grasp the most are folks that are sort of deafened to knowing what fracking is and understanding what fracking is and understanding how detrimental it is to our environment. We already have all of the activist audience. That's kind of a given with this. But the goal is to reach above and beyond that activist audience, above and beyond just the folks that really enjoy protest music, folks that, listen to Bonnie Raitt or, Anti-Flag or Rusted Root or all these great folks on the album, Michael Franti, Natalie Merchant, the Felice Brothers, obviously Tom Chapin, quite the lineup. And we're hoping to reach their audience, but really above and beyond that audience.
Tom, your audience is politically activated, I would think. Michael Franti's audience is politically activated. How do you get beyond that already convinced audience?
Yeah, I remember doing my first concert with Pete Seeger and my brother Harry 35 years ago. And somebody asked Pete Seeger, if you've done these benefit things your whole life, has that ever made a difference? And he said something that interested me, and I've always used it. I don't know. But I do know I've met the good people. People with live hearts, live eyes, and live minds. And it was such a perfect Pete Seeger deflection and yet information at the same time. In other words, I'm not doing this for me, but yet I meet the people that I care about and I learn stuff. And it's a life commitment rather than this particular thing.
Hmm. The issue of fracking is becoming more tangible and less abstract. I think people understand what is going on with fracking. I've talked with people, millionaires down in Dallas who aren't terribly politically active, who are shocked by the seismic activity
yeah.
that
yeah.
fracking produces. We have these fracking earthquakes, they say to me, what do we do about that? And there's a sense of looking for articulated message of how to push back. And in some ways, songs like this could be perfectly timed.
Yeah, we hope so. It's an interesting thing. I know here in New York, I'm a New Yorker, Governor Cuomo listened to the scientists and his people and banned fracking. And it was a big issue. And we were kind of surprised and thrilled about it. Both Jason and myself and a bunch of other folks went down to Dimmock, Pennsylvania, and right in the heart of the Pennsylvania fracking, and talked to folks whose lives have been just really ruined, and their not only their property and their water, but the community as well. And so it's really interesting I'm a normal citizen. That's what I do, but I'm also a musician. And you read about it, and then you go meet people who actually are living that life, and you go, whoa. And that really was an eye-opener for me.
Things like all the earthquakes going on, absolutely finding that fracking is tainting drinking water in Pennsylvania. I think that it becomes more believable to them. Unfortunately, it takes the press to do that. A bunch of people with protest signs at rallies are wonderful to urge the politicians to make changes. But I think to really reach a broader context and a broader audience, I think it takes a big article in the New York Times, or it takes folks like us making a record like this with, a huge built-in audience of all the fans.
Does science get in the way of clarity when you're trying to develop a protest movement? Does science get distorted by songs and the ways in which passions can boil down an issue? We struggle with this on the show all the time on all kinds of issues.
You're asking, does logic get moved by emotion? And I think the answer is yes, sometimes in the right direction, sometimes in the wrong direction. But I think you just have to go with your heart. At least this is Tom Chapin talking about Tom Chapin. What you have seen with your own eyes and what you believe. And the song that I wrote down there, I wrote with my good friend John Forster, who came up with that wonderful concept that it's just because it's down there, somehow it's the Holy Grail if we have to go get it. And why, so I think, yes, emotions do sway logic, you know that. And science sometimes is very careful about saying, yes, the earth has gotten warmer over the years, other times, but I've watched people who just absolutely discard logic because of emotion. We all have. And in fact, most of the Republican guys running for president said that there's no proof that that the earth is getting warmer because of us. And so you look at that and say, in my head, it's absolute. But that's part of what music does. Language gives information. Music gives emotion. That's what we do.
If there's a tree, we'll cut it down. Tear the top right off a mountain, leave behind the barren ground.
Jason Sammel, producer of Buy This Fracking Album, a benefit album to raise awareness of the dangers of fracking. And Tom Chapin is one of the artists, a Grammy Award-winning musician on this album. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
The way that it will go.
You can hear a full version of Tom Chapin's performance in our studio by going to thetakeaway.org. Thanks for listening to this edition of The Takeaway Weekender. Hope you had a great summer solstice. We'll see you on Monday. Until then, check everything out at thetakeaway.org and have a great weekend.
This has been The Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.